Good morning. Well, on behalf of the entire Dom Prep staff and over 20,000 readers and members worldwide, greetings and welcome to another Dom Prep executive briefing here in the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. I'm Marty Masuk, publisher of Dom Prep Journal, DomesticPreparedness.com, and the DPJ Weekly Brief, and I thank you all for attending. What a week it's been. Massachusetts, Texas, Syria, and here in our nation's capital. Thousands of Dom Prep readers have been responding, receiving, planning, triaging, sharing information, and most importantly, collaborating. Preparedness is getting better, although it's still not perfect, and I'm sure you'll agree that we really don't want to go back to where we were a decade ago. Last week, key words were reshaped and have new meaning. Just to cite a few: marathon, fertilizer, lockdown, chemical nerve agents, Chechnya, nursing home evacuations, pressure cooker bombs, shelter in place, and ricin. Fatalities occurred in each incident except here in Washington, D.C., with the deadly ricin toxin. This is significant, since in that case, there's a system in place to detect and give early warning to protect human life. And while that system may not be perfect, it worked. Now, before we begin presentations, please join me in thanking my staff, including Susan Collins, Kathy Feynman, Derek Sharp, plus our editor-in-chief, Jim Hessman. And also, thank you to the Dom Prep 40 Advisory Board, with special note to General Steve Reeves, who will head up today's briefing. And also, thank you to Dr. Jeff Runge, who actually began this discussion in September at Harvard's Faculty Club. So thank you all. Also, this briefing would not be possible without the support of its underwriters, Luminex and Emergent BioSolutions. Their sponsorship allows all of us to be here without charge, so please join me in thanking them as well. As noted, the topic today is biodefense, the threat, the cost, and the priority. A future biological incident can easily dwarf last week's headlines. Can you imagine the disruption and hysteria that would result from an incident that has the potential to kill hundreds of thousands? It's hard to imagine. So now on to the presentations.
My name is Matt Cozy. I'm a principal research analyst with NORC at the University of Chicago, and we assisted Dom Prep in analyzing some of these survey data that you see displayed over here. I got some good advice from the general to be bright, be brief, and be gone, so I'm going to do my best to live up to that. First of all, I want to give a couple of caveats, and these are important caveats for the statistical community. These are unweighted data, so unfortunately we can't generalize to all of the Dom Prep readership or to the general public. Nevertheless, these are instructive. This survey was conducted by Dom Prep and surveyed approximately 500 or 600 or so members of their readership, and then about 500 or 600, it's 575 members of the general population. And I'll cut right to it. The most important, I think, findings of this work are really reflected here. And the general thrust of it was to determine what the Dom Prep readership and non-Dom Prep readership perceived risks of various types of attacks to be. When asked, on a scale of 0 to 4, a 0 being there's not at all a risk, and then 4 almost certain that an attack will occur, I have some averages of what the general public and what the Dom Prep readership indicated their perceived threats to be. So for a biological attack, the Dom Prep readership perceived the risk to be higher, just under a 50-50 chance, and the general public did not perceive the risk to be this high. It was more like the average was 1.44, so in between somewhat unlikely and 50-50. And this was a significant difference. Going down the line, we asked about the likelihood or the perceived risk of a nuclear attack. And in this case, the Dom Prep readership and the general public were approximately the same, 1.19 and 1.14, when it came to their average perception of this risk. Interestingly, the risk perceived of a chemical attack, the Dom Prep readership thought that this was almost a 50-50 chance at 1.94. And the general public was significantly lower at 1.46. Now, the first mode of attack that we asked about, where the perceived risk was above 50-50, was a conventional attack. And the Dom Prep readership, with a ranking of 2.44, was in between 50-50 and somewhat likely. The general public, however, was below 50-50 at 1.53, indicating a significant gap between the perception of risk of a conventional attack between the Dom Prep readership and the general public. And finally, when asked about the risk of a cyber attack, the Dom Prep readership, with a ranking of 3.48, indicated that they felt this was between somewhat likely and almost certain. And while the general public also agreed that there was a greater than 50-50 chance, with a 2.80 average score. I'd like to talk about one set of associations that we saw, which was that generally, for the risk of nuclear attack, there was no effect on the response when stratified by age or by educational attainment. While that was not the case for bio, the older the respondents were, the higher their perceived risk of a biological attack. And similarly to the bio results, when asked about the possibility of a chemical attack, the older the respondents, the higher their perceived risk. That was true, again, of a conventional attack. And interestingly enough, educational attainment was not significantly correlated to perceived risk for any of the modes of attack except for cyber attack, where increase in educational attainment correlated with an increased perceived risk. And then finally, when asked about our preparedness for a biological attack, an increase in age was correlated with the feeling that we were less prepared. Also, as we can see in the graphic here, both the general public and Dom Prep readership indicated that we were poorly or adequately prepared for a biological attack. And then our very last point here on the need for investing in modernizing our biothreat detection systems. The Dom Prep readership and the general public were almost equivalent, both agreeing that this was between somewhat and very important. And there were no effects for age or educational attainment on the perceived importance of modernizing this, these systems, which indicates that this was across the board. Thank you.
Well, good morning, everybody. It's good to see a lot of familiar faces this morning. I was asked to talk about the threat this morning, and specifically the threat of the biological attack. And having started my career as an intelligence officer, giving a typical threat briefing is a pretty structured exercise. You roll out the usual suspects, Iran, Syria, North Korea, China, and so on, and describe their known and suspected capabilities, of course, without any precision about their real intentions. Second requirement in a biological threat briefing is to talk about one of the unique aspects of the biological threat, which is the explosive growth in biotechnology and the widespread knowledge of genetic engineering, the tools and techniques for bioengineering organisms that were once the province of experienced PhDs, are now routinely used in undergraduate and even some high school biology classes. For $29.95 on Amazon.com, you can buy your child the DNA Wizard Experiment Kit. The description reads, "Your child will extract DNA from a fruit, build a double helix, solve a chromosome puzzle, and transform and grow their own green glowing cells." But you're a sophisticated audience, and I'm sure you probably all know all that. There's also no shortage of academic studies, journal articles, conferences, independent reports on biological threats. And by my rough count, there are presently 8 national strategies, 5 presidential directives, along with numerous cabinet-level strategies all specifically addressing the biological threat. So what makes this particular threat so special to national security? Well, let me suggest 3 things. 1, it's multidimensional. 2, it transcends domestic and foreign policy. And 3, we will be surprised. Any biological threat event, intentional or natural, is a multidimensional problem. Attempting to fully describe and understand the true scope of the biological threats, like the label on the 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle that reads, "Some assembly required." In addition to the biowarfare agents that classically concern the Department of Defense, biowarfare is also considered nature's renewable WMD threat. Think SARS, H1N1, and so on. Another common perspective is that we're one microbiologist away from a biological attack. We certainly know that terrorist groups are attracted to biowarfare. It's cheap, pennies and dollars to develop compared to thousands of millions for other weapons, simple to employ and deploy, small vials or containers easily smuggled and simply opened in a confined space with lots of people, airplanes, shopping malls, office buildings. And, if you want, it allows plausible deniability, since it could be days or even weeks before the effects of a biological attack are seen and understood. And it's relatively easy to be made by competent scientists. And in fact, it's only due to the incompetence of terrorist-sponsored scientists that we have not seen an actual mass casualty. For example, Japan's Amshinriko cult is best known for their sarin gas attacks on the Tokyo subway in the mid-1990s. Less reported is their first efforts with WMD were with anthrax, both on an individual and a large-scale basis over the city of Tokyo. Fortunately, both their sources and their microbiologists' incompetence led to using a vaccine strain of anthrax and not a virulent strain. Of note, however, is their production capability was easily hidden, and in fact, they were quite successful in producing a significant, albeit impotent, quantity of anthrax. Likewise, we know from the 2009 H1N1 swine flu response that it's possible to go back to the future and resurrect viruses that were frozen for almost 100 years, as was done with the 1918 Spanish flu virus, which killed over 50 million people worldwide in 1918 and 1919, and more than twice the deaths in World War I. 2002, Stony Brook University in New York went one better by constructing the polio virus using its genome sequence, which was then available on the Internet, and used it as a blueprint and genetic material from one of the many companies that sell made-to-order DNA. In other words, they created a virus with genetic material that was synthesized from scratch. But the national security issues of biological warfare go beyond simply addressing the detection and response to classic or even novel biological agents. These include the social, economic, and political upheavals that go along with such an event. I'm sure many of you saw the movie Contagion, which certainly amply portrayed many of these issues. But the 2001 anthrax letters, of course, are the real-world poster event. 5 dead, 17 others seriously infected, and billions of dollars spent in remediation and preventative measures. For most Americans, however, this is an isolated incident. Like Pearl Harbor and 9-1-1, it happened, it's over, we picked up the pieces, we're resilient people, and we've moved on. A 2001 assessment in Science magazine of the so-called biodefense boom echoed this sentiment, noting that critics questioned the justification for spending on biodefense. And I'm quoting here, especially because no new attacks have occurred. If the validity of a threat depends primarily on when it was last used, the threat of a nuclear attack would seem to be negligible. After all, the last and only nuclear weapon that was ever used was used by the United States 70 years ago when the United States dropped 2 atomic bombs on Japan to end World War II. Much of the Cold War, and more recently, Iran's and North Korea's current quest for nuclear arms and the West's alarm reaction demonstrates the thinness of the when last used argument. There are likewise competing models for what the biological threat may become. According to one model, biotechnology is seen as becoming more powerful, available, familiar, and decentralized. As a result, the bioweapons threat is expected to grow in the future. A competing view is that there is a lot of uncertainty on how biotechnologies might develop in the future due to the complex social, economic, scientific, and technical factors that shape the biotech innovations and their applications. What is certainly true is that intelligence analysts face challenges in acquiring and processing information related to biological threats. There is typically little evidence of state or non-state actors developing biological weapons. In contrast, there is an overload of information about general biotechnology developments, which begs for better tools and conceptual aids to help the analysts sort through the sea of information to identify and prioritize potential security risks. Secondly, any type of biological event rapidly transcends domestic and foreign policy. February of 2003, a man from China's Guangdong province checks into the Hong Kong Metropole Hotel, ironically into room 911, and he has severe acute respiratory syndrome, or SARS. Over the course of the 2-day visit, he infects 16 more hotel guests, and within weeks, hundreds of SARS cases are reported throughout Asia, Europe, and North America as those Hong Kong hotel guests continue their travels. The final count was 8,000 SARS cases reported in 37 countries and 774 dead. A 2006 systemic review of all the studies done on the 2003 SARS epidemic found no evidence that antivirals, steroids, or other therapies helped the patients. Subsequent reviews also attributed a slow medical and policy response to Chinese secrecy and a lack of a reliable international public health network. To their great credit, many international scientists established informal networks to share information. Now fast forward to 2 weeks ago and the discovery of H7N9 bird flu in Shanghai. and major Eastern European cities and Beijing have closed their live poultry markets and are taking other precautions to limit the spread of this new virus. Shanghai state media just yesterday declared that the H7N9 situation is stable before, retrospectively, announcing that there were six new cases. The spread of the flu has nevertheless had a big impact on China's chicken industry, the world's second largest after the United States. And one of the country's most important auto exhibitions this year will be held in Shanghai. And it's being held this week, by the way. GM and Ford are among the world's most important automakers that will be on hand, trying to woo consumers in the world's biggest auto market. So what? Well, China is the world's second largest economy in a globalized economy. And to update an old cliche, when China sneezes, the world catches cold. The ripple effect of a slowdown or a shutdown of Chinese economic output is felt across markets worldwide. And just as the U.S. is dependent on Chinese imports, so too is China dependent on U.S. consumers should a biological event occur here. American vulnerability to Chinese import interruption, while probably not catastrophic, is certainly substantial to many sectors in our still fragile economy. And then there's the issue of deliberate bioterrorism or bioattacks. During the Cold War, we relied on policy models of nonproliferation, counterproliferation, preparedness, including consequence management. These policies worked, and they continue to work reasonably well for nuclear and chemical weapons, although there are notable exceptions, such as Pakistan's AQ Khan, who ran the Home Depot of nuclear proliferation. You can do it. We can help. But these treaties and their associated inspection mechanisms provide at least some degree of transparency and enforcement capabilities along that with the national signatories. The 1972 Biological Warfare Convention is a different story. In the absence of any verification or inspection measures, almost in concert with signing the treaty, many nations continued expanding their biological weapons programs. For example, according to a senior Russian defector, by the late 1980s, the Soviet biological warfare program employed some 60,000 personnel. Further, the treaty does not require the parties to declare biological agents or toxins used in non-prohibited activities. Nor are they obligated to declare all laboratories engaged in research and development of substances that could be used as biological warfare agents. In fairness, establishing transparency and inspection routines in biological research is really tough. Unlike chemical and nuclear weapons, where many potential biological agents also were legitimate public health concerns, like Ebola, Marburg, and even anthrax. And unlike chemical and nuclear research, where materials can be quantified and measured, biology is the only science where division means the same thing as multiplication. Commercial companies and even universities, both critical to biological defense research and development, are also more than reticent about the potential loss of intellectual property and competitive advantage that might come with any type of intrusive multinational inspection regime. This brings us to the issue of perceived threats. During the 2003 SARS outbreak, more than a few Asian news outlets accused the United States of launching a biological warfare attack against China and the Pacific Rim. Of course, the Internet was likewise full of conspiracy theories. Similarly, in light of the U.S. media coverage of the 2009 H1N1 flu outbreak, you can be forgiven for being slightly surprised that you aren't dead. You may recall the face masks that began appearing in the streets of New York and other cities, despite their questionable value. And around the world, some governments were not exactly the models of rational and reasoned reaction. In China, more than 70 Mexicans were quarantined despite showing no signs of flu. In Egypt, more than 300,000 pigs were slaughtered despite the fact that there were no cases of flu in that country, and that you can't get the flu from eating pork. Swine flu isn't even really swine flu. It's two parts swine, one part avian, a touch of human, though it did originate in pigs. What the leaders in these countries and much of the public did not have was accurate, actionable information on which to make decisions. But all these biological threats, intentional, natural, or perceived, have real national security consequences to our economy, social welfare, and the safety of our homeland. One criticism I have of the movie Contagion is that while all the domestic impacts of the epidemic were, in my view, well portrayed, it left out how vulnerable we become as a nation to those outside the United States who would take advantage of the situation to do us or those we protect around the world greater harm. Finally, we will be surprised. Given the multidimensional nature of the biological threat and the various overt, covert, and natural vectors of biological threats, the only real question is, how surprised? Terror-proofing our country, of course, is not possible. We are getting better at anticipating nature, but certainly can't predict with any degree of confidence what nature may come up with next. And like nature, we find that our enemies are willing to adapt and attempt to overcome our countermeasures. It's axiomatic in any biological event that time matters, and the sooner detection and identification of the threat, the better, so that we can respond appropriately. We are also in a time when budgets increasingly will not allow surprise to be addressed by maintaining large and technically diverse capabilities at high readiness. But the ability to recognize and respond adroitly to surprise remains a critical requirement for a modern national security establishment. That said, preparedness cannot be focused on a single tool for addressing the problem, but must be on a system of systems that integrates a broad range of activities. The nation's and our allies' public health resources, surveillance systems, epidemiological expertise, and laboratory networks must be integrated with healthcare, emergency management, law enforcement systems, national security systems, and others. And all of these must be connected by a system of rapidly sharing information and communicating across sectors both nationally and internationally. Reducing the threat from bioterrorism is difficult, expensive, and probably very unruly, but it has to be done. Bioterrorism is something we can't wish away. So now, having thoroughly admired the problem, what are we doing about it? Well, as the threat of bioterrorism continues to evolve and change, pushed along by international politics and trends in the biological sciences, the fields need a new infusion of energy and support. And that's what you're going to hear about next from the next several speakers. Thank you for your kind attention.
Hi, I'm Nathaniel Hubert, and I apologize if I'm a little bleary-eyed. I'm on call, actually, at my hospital, New York Presbyterian, up in New York. I got someone to cover for me today. The last time I was on call, my first day, overnight day, was October 29th. You might ring a bell for some. I had the unfortunate experience of being on call both for Sandy and for Irene, and I live in downtown Manhattan. You know, they shut the subways down, so... And we don't have cars in New York. So I actually had to bike to work both times. And that was quite interesting, too, because of all the shattered glass. So you learn some personal resilience. So I wound up, this time I was prepared. I actually had a patch kit on my bike starting on Tuesday morning. But, you know, I think that that's a really great phrase to keep in our mind, surprises. Hospitals hate surprises. Some of you in the audience have heard me talk about this. I'm talking about healthcare preparedness for bioterrorism for about 13 years now, totally by accident. I came to New York to do health services research on depression, and then folks at the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality offered, in the first couple of weeks of my being on the faculty, an opportunity to think about what would happen if there were an anthrax attack in New York City. And it turned out that nobody else in the academic world in New York City really wanted to think about that. So we took a leap, started working with folks in the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, and also the Office of Emergency Management. So that's where I got to meet folks like Eddie Gabriel, who some of you know. Long story short, it turned out that there wasn't very much written or investigated about the health impacts in a modern urban setting. There was a tremendous amount of knowledge and information about other settings having to do with anthrax. So over the last 13 years, we've tried to make some inroads into thinking about what the health costs would be of, say, an anthrax attack or a botulinum outbreak or other types of events. And that's led to a number of quantitative models that we've created looking at the impact of these. Some of them were up on the web for a while as something called the AHRQ surge model, which you might have known about, which we're trying to resurrect now. When you break down costs, obviously there are the costs of the event itself. We saw last week that hospitals in Boston were exquisitely well prepared to deal with 170-odd casualties. What was interesting from my perspective is that one of the trauma surgeons at one of the Boston hospitals thanked through the media the EMS directors in Boston who so skillfully allocated the patients appropriately, it turned out, to the various hospitals. You saw something like 30 going to Mass General and 30 going to Brigham and some going to Tufts and some going to Boston Medical Center. That's the sort of thing that often, in my experience so far, works because the people doing it do it day in and day out, and they know intimately all the details of the systems that they're dealing with. And so they minimized both the health consequences of the event, but also the disruption to normal operations. My concern with something like anthrax is that, as was mentioned before, the scale of the event could be 10 times what we saw. And at that point, all of those routine systems start to break down. So getting to the numbers, one of the things that we discovered using the information that's available about, say, how long it might take someone who's inhaled enough anthrax spores to become sick, how long it might take for them to present to a medical institution. It's, in our view, and we've published this in 2009, it's highly unlikely that an unannounced anthrax attack could be met by a sufficient medical response that nobody would get sick and nobody would die. In fact, in our estimation, even with extremely rapid clinical detection and extremely efficient mass prophylaxis, you're still talking about somewhere on the order of 1 to 10% of all the potential casualties becoming casualties, simply because you can't get the antibiotics to people in time. Now, that's with standard operating procedure. I'm not talking about everyone having antibiotics in their home or, for example, the postal system, which hasn't been fully modeled on a national scale, coming in and distributing things really rapidly. But in any way that we respond, there are going to be casualties if something of the magnitude of what was just discussed occurs. And that's a sobering thought. So that's the cost of the event. The other costs, and this is really what I have dealt with for the most part, because these events haven't for the most part occurred except 2001 and then the odd Ricin letter and things like this that keep bringing it up in people's mind. The other cost is the preparedness cost. And I've, along with many other people, written about how we've spent $60 billion over the last decade or so on preparedness. But at the hospital level, it really comes down to, why should we be spending money on this? Just yesterday, I asked one of the pulmonary critical care fellows, as we were fiddling with a chest tube set up, I said, how many of these do we have in the hospital? And he looked at me and said, a lot. We got one on every floor. And I thought, okay, that's a good answer, but that's the wrong answer. We need to know how many, and we need to know what our supply chain is, and we need to see whether we need to pay our suppliers more so that in a time of crisis, we could make sure that we get them. Same thing that you do with Xerox if you want to make sure your copier gets prioritized service. So there are ways in which the issue of the risk, the faraway risk of the possibility of something super bad happening, and the day-to-day minimal operating margin that most hospitals, including mine, operate on, there's a huge gulf between those two. And I would say that if you take a step back from the human cost of an event, a biological event, the larger cost issue that we're talking about now is thinking our way through on an ongoing basis so that we're not reeling in response to 2001 or some other acute incident, is figuring out a way to square hospital preparedness with the ongoing low day-to-day risk that something very bad will occur where you are and exactly at the time that you don't want it to happen. So what can we do about this? Well, one of the things that I've been trying to do with the modeling work that my team has done, and this is mostly at Cornell with the engineering department. As some of you might know, there's a big tech campus being built in New York with the support of the Bloomberg administration. Cornell and Technion University from Israel are going to be joining forces, and one of the three arms of that is health, and it's health in terms of the technology of health. One of the things that we've been doing to try to get this ball rolling is taking a really sharp look at how hospitals work and where the efficiencies that could be found exist in hospitals that could do things like increase our surge capacity internally. There's been a big turn, as some of you might know, in the last several years from thinking about hospitals building out to hospitals building in. None of the hospitals in Boston for the marathon bombing had to set up tents. They all managed internally how their patients were moving. They discharged people. This happened extremely rapidly. Our investigation so far in a couple of the operating rooms in our own hospital, and these are actually not the main ORs, but the ambulatory ORs, is that if we just increase communication and integrate people's activities in a better way, we could probably save about an hour a day per operating room of overtime or lost time. And that can translate to millions of dollars just for our own hospital. and hundreds of millions of dollars across the country. This is internal space that we have that we are not aware of. And the way that we accomplish finding that space is through better collaborative communication. So I see a parallel between what we're talking about in terms of EMS talking to hospitals or fire and EMS. And once you get inside the hospital working in a more effective way amongst itself. One strange fact about our hospital is that we have 300 people just working in our laundry. We pose to our fourth-year medical students who are taking a special session before they graduate, special session on emergencies and bioterrorism. We pose the question of what would happen if even a large portion, not all, but a large portion of those people became sick, let's say with a bad flu. What would happen to the hospital if that were to occur? It would grind to a halt, I assure you. And so we have to come up with innovative ways for the hospital to be flexible in the face of this surprise, flexible both in terms of its day-to-day operations and flexible in terms of its emergency operations. So I think even though we've been talking about this since 2001 and have been coming up with some very effective solutions, I think there's a tremendous distance that we can still go. And the way that we'll get there is with improved technology in the hospital, but also improved planning for a long-term threat and an improved way of thinking about how hospitals can work together. Sandy was also very interesting in that it knocked out two of our major hospitals, and we still don't really have a good handle on how events like that will affect the healthcare network in a given location. One of the things that happened to us is that we received patients on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday of that week from some of these other hospitals. We also received patients earlier from our own downtown hospital, which had to close because it's dependent on the New York City steam system. They knew the steam was going to be turned off, and they said, that's it. That will close us down. We have to ship all of our patients out. One thing to think about is how many systems now do we have that are electronic, say, without which the hospital will close. So I was very impressed with the numbers that are interested in the possibility of a cyber attack. I think that we face a whole new set of threats with the increasing electronification of health records now, that hospitals might be dealing with the acute event, the casualties. They might be dealing with long-term questions about how to provide enough funding for the flexibility that you need and the interoperability that you need to prepare for all these surprises. The problem that we face with hospitals is that we don't then want to make everything dependent on seamless electronic communication. Last example is that the patient that we got from downtown hospital arrived, this is our own in-network hospital, arrived with no paperwork because all of their paperwork has become electronic. When we called downtown hospital, obviously we couldn't get through because they were shuttered. So there was no way of even accessing the backup within our own system because we didn't know which backup to go to. So here was one hospital that wound up being completely closed down. So we're investigating this now. I mean, there's got to be a way for us to accomplish this type of simple record retrieval. But the risk that I see to hospitals is that it could compound any biological event if there's any deviation from the norm in terms of both simple things like electricity, but more complicated things like the smooth operation of electronic systems. As a nation, we're increasingly choosing among a smaller number of electronic health record providers. And for those of you in the room who work on this, and I'm sure there are some, I think the security and resiliency of those systems is increasingly becoming a new national security priority. Because without those records, nothing happens. It's hard to order medicine for the patient in the hospital. It's hard to understand what their past medical history is. It's hard to communicate with anybody else who takes care of them. So a number of things on the horizon, and I'll stop there. I'd be happy to take questions later. Thanks.
Good morning. My name is Eric Gall. I'm with the Metropolitan Police Department here in D.C. Thank you for your presentation. It's been a concern of mine for a long time about the readiness of the healthcare system to respond to a bioterrorism event. I was working for the mayor in 2001 when we dealt with Marathrax here, and we had huge numbers of people that were seeking prophylaxis even though they didn't need it. My real question goes to the notion of whether healthcare workers are actually going to respond to take care of all of these people, because Christine Qureshi, who I'm sure you're familiar with, published in 2005 an article that dealt with the willingness of healthcare workers to come in. And back then she found out that 61% didn't want to come in for a smallpox event. So I think some serious thought has to be given to how we're going to actually coax the people that know the most about the medical effects of a highly contagious weapon to come and treat all those people that are going to now be seeking, whether they're affected or not, treatment and all the security concerns that come with that, because we had to provide a huge amount of security at DC General while we were doing our screening and prophylaxis.
It's a great question. I think the counterpoint to that survey that was done is what we saw last week. I mean, there are obviously a lot of news articles about the folks who ran in, even as the smoke was still thick, and perhaps even as the second bomb was going off 12 seconds later. I would want a repeat of that survey now that some of the fear about the smallpox threat has dissipated. I would want a survey that asks about more common things and not such unusual things. So, for example, influenza. You know, a lot of this happened during HIV. There was a weeding out of people going into medical school. I actually got into medical school in the easiest time ever because it was the height of the uncertainty about HIV in the late 80s. And a lot of people went to law school instead. So I think what you've got, no problem. I didn't mean to insult any lawyers in the room. But I think what you've got is a maturing of people's understanding of risks. I believe that the health workforce is extremely dedicated, as I'm sure many of you do, and I believe that if an event like this were to occur, sure, you'd have some people who probably for good reasons wouldn't be able to come into work. They need to care for their family, their young children, things like that. But on the whole, I don't think that there would be a fleeing from the battle. I think there would be something that we saw last week, which is people coming in. On the other hand, not enough attention has been paid to treating those people like critical infrastructure and key workforce, and protecting them in the best way that we can. We've actually done a little bit of work on this. There's more to do. We've got some modeling that needs to be done about what to do with a little bit of money and a lot of people and a couple of antivirals.
Tim Stevens, Emergency Services Coalition for Medical Preparedness and National Sheriff's Association. I agree with what you say there, Dr. Hubert. Might debate whether or not some of the security aspects would be appropriately moving forward, but that's for another time. We'd like to hear a little bit more about the medical supply issues, both in Sandy and then I think some of the consequences that you draw from that in the current way we structure healthcare.
Sure. I'm having a meeting at 3:30 with our own hospital, my own hospital, to discuss supply chain issues with them. We don't know the full extent of what occurred. What we do know is that our hospital, like many others around the country, have what's called a PAR system, where you have, if it's a three-day PAR, you're supposed to have 3 days' worth of stuff in the hospital. And when we went with a bunch of very eager Masters of Engineering students a couple of years ago to investigate that, it turned out that it wasn't quite that simple. There was about a day and a half worth of stuff on the shelf, about a half day of stuff was being used on the ward, and then the other day worth of stuff was actually somewhere electronically being passed between our hospital and the warehouse that we have up in Westchester, not our warehouse, a different company's warehouse, or in a truck on the way to the hospital. So what we thought was a nice three-day buffer turned out to be a pretty precarious one-and-a-half-day buffer. Whether we're going to do something about that or not is a whole other question, because it takes money to invest in a different type of infrastructure to actually manage the larger inventory. One of the things that we've learned from talking with industry is that if you want a better supply chain, you have to pay for it. And at this point, it's unlikely that any hospital in the country is going to even tolerate the idea of paying even more for their supplies than they pay already. So if we want to move that dial at all, we have to come up with good quantitative models for why they should. And we're in the middle of that, but I don't think we're there yet. The whole other question during the pandemic about, this is my problem with Contagion is slightly different with the movie. It was that there was still stuff. I mean, there were things to use. And, you know, we know now that most of this comes, for example, through Long Beach from China. You know, we have our masks, our N95s. We have our raw materials here in North America. But a lot of the raw materials don't come from here. And so if you've got months of a globally devastating epidemic like was portrayed in Contagion, I can't imagine the disruption that would occur to the critical supply chains. We proposed this in 2006, but there wasn't a lot of interest back then. I would still like to see a really in-depth, maybe other people in the room have done this already, and that would be great, but I haven't seen a really in-depth look at the vulnerabilities in the entire healthcare supply chain for critical materials, the plastic and the tubes that connect people to the vents, for example. This is something we should know about. So it's a great question. It's not answered.
Jeff Runge, I'm an independent consultant. And Nathaniel, I'm going to thank you for coming down here today and for talking a bit about this. You know, your talk actually has a whole bunch of implications, but some of them I thought are worth pointing out here. Number one is our complete dependence on the integration of private sector resources for national security. And to the extent that there has been a dependence but lack of planning, a couple of small grant programs which went out with very little guidance to healthcare facilities about how to spend that money, and it was still the case today. I wanted your thoughts on one thing, and that is that I think, as you pointed out, your modeling depended upon a clinical view of how pulmonary anthrax occurs. As I think you may hear from Dr. Wells later on, we've started to rethink those sorts of organisms, what that might look like, how soon they might present, and the effectiveness of prophylaxis. So as I recall the numbers from your work, with 2.4 million people exposed in a rather homogeneous fashion to anthrax spores, you calculated about 200,000 to 500,000 people needing prophylaxis, and you said even at the absolute optimal point, 1 to 10% would show up critically ill in the emergency departments in New York City. So those numbers are 20 to 30,000 people. I've looked at it a bunch.
But now that he's mentioned it,
can you just talk for a second? Yeah. Now, you know, I mean, I will harken back to US Air 1016 going down in Charlotte, and we were heroes for managing 19 people and another 30 ambulatory people from a plane crash. You know, I just want to emphasize the magnitude of what you're talking about for even a fairly inefficient organism like anthrax. Can you talk a bit about the status of a city like New York, the status of the hospitals, and what it might look like for 20 or 30,000 people who require critical care, ventilation, and so forth?
It's a tough question to answer, but an important question. It wouldn't look good. Any of you who visited an emergency department in a major urban center know, you know, we operate on no margin. My colleagues at UC Davis, who've done some very sophisticated modeling of their own, of the emergency status of their own emergency department, they're on the highway between San Francisco and Sacramento, they routinely run at the highest level of oversaturation about 20 to 30% of the time. So this would be obviously a calamity of not having space to put people. Now, that having been said, the data, unpublished data from our hospital after 9/11 is that we were able, over the course of about 24 hours, to get something like 30 to 40% of people, if not out of the hospital, at least moved out of beds that could then be reoccupied. So I think that there is a tremendous amount of surge capacity within the hospitals that exist. In a setting like that, we would see a handful of cases early on. And let me just make a parenthetical remark about anthrax. There's still tremendous debate about the shape of these what are called incubation distribution curves, whether it would take someone 2 days or 9 days. There have been a number of publications over the last decade about this. There's often a reference to the Sverdlovsk 1979 event in Russia, where you had 70 to 80 cases well documented and probably more that weren't documented. And then there are a tremendous number of animal models. If you go back to the 60s, you have famous papers by folks like Glassman, who note the thousands of, unfortunately, thousands of primates who were sacrificed without really good evidence that the primate data really applies in humans. So, and that's stated up front in at least some of those papers. So we are going on thin evidence about what the shape of this distribution looks like. But if there were to be 20,000 cases showing up in New York City, it would be, you know, on the positive side, it wouldn't be all at once. It's not like a nuclear detonation or a very, very large blast. It's not like a Boston. There is a time component. It's perhaps a week or 10 days that would be the distribution of the cases that either didn't get prophylaxis or escaped prophylaxis. But it would require, again, as many people in the room know all too well, it would require a huge regional effort, especially a transport effort. And this is something that I think we need to think seriously about. How do we do mass transport of people, for example, who require mechanical ventilation? You know, this is where having a good train system in the country would actually come in handy.
Hi. First, I want to thank all of you for tremendous presentations, even though you haven't been hit with questions yet.
Yeah,
but I'm afraid I'm going to bother you on this one. My name is Leonard Cole. I am with the Program on Terror Medicine and Security at the University of Medicine and Dentistry in New Jersey. And coincidentally, I had an op-ed piece which was solicited from me by the Bergen Record, the Record, which is New Jersey's largest northern newspaper, on this very subject. It was just published yesterday, and I just want to point to two, I think, important features about this. First, I believe everyone, or almost everyone in the room, realizes that there were an extraordinary number of amputations as a consequence of the blast at the Boston Marathon. My count is that there were 17 reported as having been done or completed in hospitals, in addition to an unknown number that were on the field. What I haven't heard much about, although a little bit from you, is how unrepresentative the medical capabilities were in Boston. I know that at the New York Marathon, there are more than 1,000 medical volunteers who are at stations in tents across the 26-mile line, heavily concentrated at the finish line. The Boston bombing was at the finish line. Within moments, literally, there were people, medical professionals, physicians, nurses, others, EMS people, on the spot who were able to staunch bleeding that in most circumstances that I can conceive of would never have been the case. And beyond that, as you referenced, there were in fact a dozen hospitals within a mile or two with top-notch capabilities. This is not typical. So the second point that I make is that there is a field, probably it's the title of it is unfamiliar to many of you, terror medicine. Google it. You'll see some things emerging. It is something that I think carries over into the need beyond this room for an awareness of how one responds to mass casualty terror and other disaster events. So I thank you, and I just hope that we raise the consciousness of this whole issue beyond those who are already concerned about it in this room.
Yeah, I'll just point out, you know, downtown Manhattan lost one of its two hospitals in the last several years because of financial concerns. I mean, it ran out of money. So if an event like what happened in Boston were to happen at the Stock Exchange, you'd have a transportation nightmare, really, especially if it had happened a couple of weeks ago when we had our trauma receiving center at Bellevue knocked out because of Sandy. I mean, you can start to think through some of the problems that would occur if that were to have happened anywhere except right in the middle of all of the Harvard teaching hospitals.
Ellen Gursky, Analytics Services, thank you. Excellent presentations. And I want to take advantage of having military and civilian expertise at the podium. You know, we are used to the scenes of medics under fire running to the rescue of soldiers in a battlefield condition. I was very concerned in Boston to watch EMS and untrained, well-meaning volunteers run into action in a situation where there could be more bombers and more bombs. And I am wondering, as we think forward, hopefully, on more events and future events, how we dissuade some of our natural intentions to help others, which could indeed wind up being far more tragic, far more injured, far more casualties. And what we're thinking in terms of civilian from military expertise to protect people.
Well, I'll take a shot at that. I can't say that I can speak specifically to what is being done. I can tell you what we ultimately had to do in Iraq and Afghanistan. And those who are professionals in the terrorism business here in the United States know well that when the first bomb goes off, what you want to do against all human nature is you need to wait to see if there's going to be a second bomb behind it. And we've seen too many instances overseas, but we've also seen domestic instances where that's exactly what happened. And so we had to go through quite a training process with our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines to get them to understand that the first bomb is not necessarily the last bomb. And so beyond the simple education process and trying to control that very human response to run to the issue, I'm not sure I've got any smarter answers than that. I can tell you that's what we did with our folks to greater and lesser effect.
Thanks, Ellen. So as Ellen knows, I live in downtown Manhattan, and so I was actually at home when the first plane hit the Twin Towers and had been working for the prior year with folks like Eddie Gabriel and OEM. And my new training from them was get the civilians out of there. You know, they're not supposed to, we have enough, in New York at least, we have enough people that anyone who's not supposed to be there should not be there. And that probably saved my life because I, after taking some photographs from my roof, when the second plane came over, I went downstairs, got my wife, got our dog, and said, let's go that way. And we walked actually around. Another person living in Battery Park City at the time, I think she was an anesthesiology resident living in Gateway Plaza, immediately when the first plane hit ran across and she died. And she's the heroine and I'm the guy who saved my hide and my wife's hide and my dog. But I feel like that was the training that I got. And so there's a balance between heroism, the thing that people instinctively do, and this idea that this is perhaps a longer, I mean, this is the second bomb. It's a longer war than that. The photographs in New York Presbyterian Hospital of the afternoon of 9/11 are of up to 100 people in white coats waiting in the ED for something to happen. And I've now worked with the engineers who do scheduling enough to know that that was the wrong response, that someone should have come in there, and this is where leadership comes into it. Someone should have come in there and said, okay, half of you guys, go home, because this might be a long-term thing. Go home and go to sleep, and then come back in, and let's do this in shifts. So, you know, there's no right answer, but I think that it's new ground, certainly for the medical students and the young doctors around the country who really get, I'll second this, they get very little training in any of this. You know, I'm the only guy at Cornell who does stuff related to terrorism, and that's a problem. I feel like Groucho Marx, you know, if I'm in that club, I'm not going to get the joke right, but any terrorism training club that would let me in, they've got to get somebody better. So, okay. Thanks for having me. What I'm going to do is I'm going to change the direction a little bit. My forte is the technology of CB Defense. And we've had a very good morning where we talked about public health aspects. And afterwards, that following me, we have Keith, Maureen, and Steve that are going to cover some other topics. And so what I want to do is I want to be the widget guy. And I talked to Marty, and Marty had asked me, he's like, what's the next big thing in environmental surveillance? What's the next big thing in terms of the technology of providing our protection? And so over the last many years, we've talked, there's a phrase that all of you have heard, where we talked about a multi-tiered, complementary layer defense strategy. Many devices, as General Reeves talked, family of systems, system of systems, working in concert to provide us with an informed data fusion, common operating picture. And so what I'm going to do is I'm really going to talk about the next big thing in the area of CB defense as it relates to systems. What I'm not going to talk about is I'm not going to talk about vaccination programs, and I'm not going to talk about post-attack response and recovery, although those are critical aspects. All of us know those things. There's maybe some other comments that follow in regards to those areas. For the purpose of the very short amount of time that I have, I want to talk to you about what we're thinking now about what environmental surveillance really is. But bear with me, and let's really consider environmental surveillance in terms of the environment, okay? We're not really just talking about point detectors that sit in a field and collect air. Really, we're looking about an all-hazards assessment of the environment that we operate in as human beings, as our dogs and our cats, in a more holistic fashion. And so over the last decade, we've seen a number of key seminal documents that have come out. The National Health Security Strategy in 2009, HSPD 21, 10, 9, so many documents. We've also seen PPD2, the National Strategy for Countering the Biological Threat in 2009. And many of those really had a theme that has become dominant for many of us that are in the area of widget management, which is really a situational all-hazards awareness. What many are calling biosurveillance. And environmental surveillance is really a key attribute of biosurveillance, as is public health management and the creation of data-fused awareness situations in which we're getting many data feeds that are coming in. We've seen also the establishment of biosurveillance coordination units within the CDC, and they've also led to the publication of the National Biosurveillance Strategy for Human Health in 2008. The establishment of the National Animal Health Surveillance System by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Animal Plan and Health Inspection Services. But what I wanted to do is I wanted to pull a quote out of another group, which was the CDC's Biosurveillance Coordination Unit established the National Biosurveillance Advisory Subcommittee, MBAS, which is a federal advisory committee. And in 2009, they issued a report. I want to pull a comment out of that report, which kind of phrases where my thinking started when Marty had asked me to make comments. They issued a report in 2009 in which they made two recommendations related to technology investments, spending our money to make widgets. There was a need for, number one, government investments in electronic health records and electronic laboratory data that should be leveraged to improve how we serve biosurveillance and public health missions. And number two, the federal government must make strategic investments in new technologies, for example, genomics, supply chain management, visualization, display dashboards, for the purpose of strengthening the U.S. biosurveillance capabilities. So now let's jump forward a few years. Right now, I'm with the U.S. Army, and I'm also working with the Joint Program Executive Office for Chemical and Biological Defense within the Department of Defense. And one of the programs that we're doing right now is an advanced technology demonstration called JUPITER, which is based out of the Korean Peninsula for the support for the U.S. forces in Korea. And I think that JUPITER is a good example of what an advanced technology demonstration can do, particularly as it's focused on biosurveillance. And when JUPITER kicks off in a few months, what it will do is test some of these new paradigms for investment in technologies. There's four legs to what JUPITER will do. Some of those legs are in the area of data fusion to create information portals. Some of those are in the area of fielding environmental sensors, the traditional sense of these. Another leg is in the area of early warning. As we move, ultimately our objective would be to detect to warn, but where we are right now is in what we call detect to treat. And then finally, another one would be in the area of the response in laboratories that would
provide higher credibility or assessment of samples that have been pulled from those sensors. And as you cobble those legs together, what you get is this multi-tiered complementary layered system of labs, of early warning, of situational awareness. And this really harmonizes for me because over the last 3 years, the Edgewood Chemical Biological Center has been investing a lot of money with our partners in the development of test beds, in which we're looking at a variety of the latest and greatest widgets. I like that word, widgets, because there's all manner of sins. And when I say detector, the medical practitioners out there are thinking of point of care. When I say detectors out there, some of maybe General Reeves might be thinking about a point detector that would protect an airfield. So detector is really a broad word. Why don't we, for the purpose of today, really consider them data sources? Okay, a detector is a piece of machinery that provides data that then feeds into a common operating picture. If you're a doctor, you can just keep calling it a point of care. I know you will anyway. But they're sources of data that feed our understanding of what's going on in the environment. And so as I've gotten into the testbed, and we've spent a significant investment of money to acquire the best devices and put them in a head-to-head comparison, and then to get soldiers to take them out into the field, we have a mock training village, an abandoned housing complex that we've turned into a little town. We call it Suburnie Village. And you're really seeing how these devices go. And when you actually take something out in the rain, in the fog, at night, it really performs a lot differently than it does in the laboratory. And it gives you a dose of reality. And so here's the response to Marty's question, what's the next wave in biodefense? What's the next big thing as it relates to the technology of providing protection to our first responders, to our public? And I know that when I look at these things, and maybe perhaps you do too, you want me to tell you that there's a tricorder out there. You want me to tell you that there's a machine that I can point to and be like, this is the next great thing that's out here, okay? And if you want that, you can watch Star Trek. It is on TV tonight, I am sure, on cable, okay? The answer that I'm going to give you is my personal opinion in that it's there. I cannot point to a device over here that's going to do that. I can't even point to a series of devices that's going to provide you with a revolutionary change in our ability to stretch towards that thing, which is detect to warn. Okay, where we are is firmly in the best utilization of the technology that we have in detect to treat. The ability to detect subsequent to that exposure in such a manner as to minimize, to close that gap from the moment that you've been attacked to the moment that you administer post-exposure prophylaxis and begin to deal with the circumstances for responding and recovering from that attack and minimizing that. And we've all seen the paradigms that the sooner we respond, the smaller that casualty gap gets. And what I've come to realize is the reality is that many of the pieces that we already really need are there. They're just not being put together in the right way. We have pieces on the board, but we're just not playing a good game of chess. And what I'm seeing, particularly as it relates to the reality of dealing with the Korean Peninsula and really propagates to Bagram, propagates to, you know, any of the proving grounds in the United States, is that we need to field a greater number of detectors. I have three. Well, we call them harsh realities. That's what we called them in college. I don't know what they call them anymore. That was a long time ago. The first one is we need a greater number of data sources. We need to put lots of them out there. The larger the number, there's a number of models that you'll see where you actually, as you create multiplicity, you're decreasing the false positive rate. So lots and lots and lots of detectors that are out there, lots and lots of data sources of different types that are out there. You can't just place one beautiful Cadillac of a machine out at the far end of an airbase and be like, we're good. One detector is not going to do it because it can come from anywhere, okay? And each detector has its own idiosyncrasies about it. The second harsh reality is that we need to make them sustainable, something that we seem to have let get forgotten along the way. Sustainable is a great word because there's a number of things that are wrapped up into there. Many of you hear the word sustainable and you hear the most important fact, affordable. If we can't afford to keep it, it's not a sustainable system. And we've created a lot of these. I've created a lot of these. Many of us are still creating a lot of these. There's a phrase, again, that the JPU loves because the acquisition community teaches us, the total life cycle cost, the burden of the system. Can you supply it? Can you maintain it? How long will it last? All these things are wrapped up. And it's not just money, but money's a big thing right now because we are in fiscally constrained times. fiscally austere times. That's our new phrase. It's a big reality, which is we have services out there, and they're like, I have a lot of demands on my time, on my wallet. I can't afford the burden that this protection implies on me. So, and the third one is that we need to make them interoperable. We have systems that are out there, but they can't talk to one another. They can't inform our common operating picture. And we have other agencies that are making devices that are good machines, and it's not the same machine. And we're not working with those other agencies. It's almost like those stovepipes are allowed to exist. And so a number of us actually put out a paper about 2 years ago, which actually, when I remember we were talking about what's the future, I thought immediately of this because we haven't made a significant amount of progress. And in this paper, we had four specific recommendations in the area of what's the next big thing. What do we need to do next in order to enable the reality of the situation? And the first recommendation was our group strongly recommended the development of a biosurveillance R&D roadmap with an emphasis on the technologies that are flexible, adaptable, and enabling prediction and early warning of health threats. Well, I'm pleased to say that the White House and the interagency community have aggressively engaged on that, and we have made significant progress. Parts of that are already done. Parts of that will be done. The interagency partners have also made significant progress, HHS, DOD, in fleshing out their own internal obligations and roles and responsibilities in the area of BSV. Here's the other three that we haven't made as much progress on. We proposed an interagency requirements building process to inform a formal set of biosurveillance requirements that will support an R&D roadmap and the development of interagency acquisition. There's our phrase, interagency acquisition. The fact is that we have agencies that are developing devices that are duplicative, that are essentially performing the same function, and we're not investing our dollar in a logical manner. And so a point-of-care detector being developed by Agency A and a point-of-care detector being developed by Agency B loses the possibility of economy of scale, because the price of that device isn't buying a $50,000 point-of-care device. It's in developing the assays and validating the assays and maintaining the internal QA. It's all the other stuff, okay? And if each of us was developing a common platform, we could be pooling all of our money and achieving economy of scale, because that $50,000 machine, when you buy 100, is going to drop to $45,000 when you buy 500, and so on and so on. And so you're achieving that first objective that I talked about, which is to field a greater number of data sources, and the third, that are interoperable, that work together, and now you have economy of scale. The third recommendation that we talked about was to then develop an acquisition strategy that maximally leverages joint investments and cooperative ventures to field an interoperable, integrated biosurveillance family of systems. And when I say this, I'm not really, the opportunity for us to do this nationally is imperative. The opportunity for us to even engage our global partners, our allies, adds an additional dimension, because as we know, disease knows no borders. And so global investment, I look right now at our allies in the UK, and they're at a crossroads where they're making acquisition decisions to develop point-of-care devices for their military, as are the Australians, as are the Canadians. And so we had an opportunity, I say in the past tense, we had an opportunity to align those programs. Have we missed that boat? Probably. Are we going to miss the next boat that's going to occur? Because this is not a need that's going to go away. And then finally, the last recommendation as I wind down on my time here would be the recommendation to conduct an assessment of the current data standards, the data use policies, and conformance and testing standards, which currently present barriers to data sharing and interoperability. And we recommend the establishment of a roadmap to integrate biosurveillance data with critical interagency nodes, for example, NBIC, NBIS, and the ICLM, which is the Interagency Consortium of Laboratory Networks. Data standards, open architectures, these are things that aren't really as glamorous as building devices, but they're critical to essentially achieving that economy of scale, achieving that interoperability, and they actually are the most mundane but critical obstacles to our successful implementation of a biosurveillance strategy. So as I wind down, I'm sorry that I'm not pointing to a device over here that's perfect. And maybe you might not agree with what I'm saying in terms of our lack of cooperation. I would ask you a couple questions. In your mind, are we cooperating as an interagency community on leveraging and joint investments? Are we duplicating investments? Are you aware in your head, just rhetorical question, of duplicate investments? And really, at the end of the day, for us in the DoD and hopefully for the others, our investments are really generated by requirements. And I would ask the question, are our requirements that different that they warrant duplicative investments? And if they're not, then why aren't we really working together better? And so I appreciate your time, and thank you very much.
Good morning. I'm Keith Wells, and as Dr. Arungi has intimated, I'm about to make Dr. Ewert's life a lot more complicated. And going to do that by reviewing some of the lessons that were learned from the U.S. Offensive Biological Weapons Program that ran until the 1969-1970 timeframe. In particular, going to talk about some of the findings from the Project 112, which ran from the 1961-62 timeframe from the Kennedy administration until the program was closed by Nixon in 69-70. And Project 112 represented a major intensification in the development of biological weapons by the United States as a strategic alternative to nuclear weapons, in particular a substitute for neutron bombs, essentially. And it was the desire to create weapons systems that drove the innovations that came out of the Project 112 program. Some of those lessons that were learned, the first being that all agents are not created equal. These folks screened dozens, if not hundreds, of different organisms, toxins, etc., and settled upon a very select few, the top three of which were tularemia, Staph aureus B, and anthrax, pretty much in that order. The other key finding from that era was that they had a big emphasis on the characteristics and the properties of the particles that were used to disseminate these agents. And we'll get into some of that in a moment. Importantly, what they did was to transform naturally occurring organisms, disease agents, and turning them into non-natural disease-causing entities. And to do this, they switched the route of administration. They found that was important. For instance, best example is the use of toxin molecules delivered via the inhalation route. Changes the whole clinical profile. The other thing that they found was that the state of the materials, the particles that they were producing, mattered tremendously. With dry particles being much more effective than the wet particles, often by 100-fold. Very important third thing that they found out was that the size of the particles was very, very important, with smaller generally being better in this case. With the particles ranging, they found that the optimal size for the particles was between 1 and 5 microns. And by doing so, they deliver it to a different target region of the airway. As opposed to remaining in the upper airway with a larger particle, these 1 to 5 micron particles were directed towards the lower lung, the deep lung, the bronchioles, and the alveoli. And by so doing, when it's delivered to the target area, they found that both the infectivity and the lethality of the agents was dramatically increased. Particular incubation periods were compressed, whereas the natural disease may take 4 days, 6 days, 8 days in order to manifest itself. These were compressed down as little as 24 hours. In some of the animal studies, they discovered that they could get lesions in the lung 24 hours after administration of the agent. Same thing for the toxins. When they used larger toxins, they would get impacts, in the roughly 18, 24-hour time frame. That can be dropped down to 6, 4, even 1 hour, depending on the dose. And also the dose that was required to produce a lethal result in half of the recipients, the so-called LD50s, could also be impacted on by the size of the particle. By using the smaller particles, you can drop that by a factor of hundreds or even 1,000, where before it took 10,000 organisms in the larger part to exert the effect. Now you were down around 100 organisms were producing the same effect. They were producing it earlier. And then finally, one of the other things that came out of it was the concept of the overwhelming dose. The dose is far exceeding anything that you're going to see with a natural infection. This is no longer some poor, unfortunate landscaper out on Martha's Vineyard running over a rabbit carcass and getting dust up of tularemia that the rabbit had. This is thousands, tens of thousands, perhaps millions of particles hitting that fellow's lungs. And the overwhelming dose can not only, they found, that can compress the incubation period, but also, very importantly, can overcome the impact of antibiotics and vaccines. So it's a whole different ballgame. These are not natural diseases that we're talking about seeing. And finally, one of the things that towards the end of the Project 112 program was the use of combination weapons, the use of both toxins and infectious agents at the same time in the same munition. And that quite simply is not something found in nature. It takes it completely out of the realm of natural disease and plants it squarely in the realm of biological weapons. I was going to talk a little bit about the democratization of biology over the past few years and also the innovations in bioprocessing and biopharma and biotechnology. All of that has driven innovations in the study of bacterial physiology, virulence factors in bacteria, fermentation technology. It's all being driven by companies producing biological products for the marketplace, purifications, the whole field of delivery of biologics via the aerosol route, the inhaled insulins, for instance, was not even, you know, a dream back when the U.S. had the BW program. That's all under development today, and what that has done in turn is driven innovations in the technology required to produce these products, regulatory requirements from the Food and Drug Administration to control dose and control where do you deliver the dose in the lung has driven innovations in the manufacturing processes for all these products. These companies spend an awful lot of time producing these products, and thus they don't want to lose it just sitting on the shelf. So increases in stabilization, change innovations in formulations of these things. All of that's come together to sort of break the monopoly that states once had on this type of effort. So thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much for having me here. I'm excited to talk to you all a little bit. When Marty and I talked, he gave me the title of Public Health Response to an Event. So, you know, the topic is like this, and I'm going to come to you today from the public health laboratory perspective, and I'm really going to talk to you about the diverse public health response that we have and the surveillance systems that we have in place and a lot of the tools in the toolbox. So it should be a pretty quick 15 minutes. So I do need to say, what is public health? Those of us in the room really do know and understand what public health is. It's really about community health. You know, it's about prevention of disease and promotion of health. And then from the laboratory perspective, it's really about disease detection. So in 1988, the IOM sent out a report on the future of public health. Most of you in this room are probably familiar with that. But it really looked at three overarching principles of public health, being assessment, policy development, and assurance. And then they created 10 essential services. From the public health laboratory side, we've created 11 essential services of public health laboratories. And that really deals with looking at not only the person and their disease, but really looking at, again, at community and population. It's been said that healthcare, it's important to us and vital to us some of the time, but public health is really important to all of us all of the time. So public health laboratories are first responders. When I started in this, you know, 20 years ago, I never thought that I would be a first responder and that I would know folks like the FBI through networking and things. But we really are on the front line, and we are our Sentinel Lab clinical lab partners are in the first line and doing that initial disease detection. Within the 11 core functions, we're looking at things like disease detection. We're looking at reference and specialized testing. Partnerships and communication are hugely important. Training and education. And then public health emergency response. The laboratory really plays a key role in detection and confirmation of those threats. I have a story that I've told many times now in the last year and a half about a small lab in rural Minnesota that has attended our trainings, that we communicate with regularly, that called us one Friday afternoon in August and said, we have this sample we can't rule out of Bacillus anthracis. And this is something we get commonly, and we said, okay, sure, well, what's the source of that? And they said, well, we actually have 4 blood culture bottles that are positive. So we all sort of think, that is a little more interesting than what we normally would hear about. So we worked with them through the systems we have in place and had them send the samples in, and I'm actually out the door on my way to on vacation, so I'm thinking I'm done with this, until Saturday morning I get a call in my car that says, by the way, that anthrax was positive. So in Fergus Falls, Minnesota, back in 2011, we had a naturally acquired case of inhalational anthrax. And I give this talk normally in about 45 minutes, but every step of the way the sample, the way the patient was handled, everything was perfect. And I think in our field, we look at these small rural labs and think, one, they'll never see something like this, and two, they won't be able to handle it. Well, I'm here to tell you that this laboratory actually did an absolutely fantastic job. They were looking at growth and culture place in 6 hours. If that had occurred in Minneapolis or St. Paul in one of our big institutions, that's a 24-hour thing. They put it in the incubator, and they don't think about it till the next day. But this particular laboratory, because of the training and the collaborations that we had, they just did a fabulous job. So what I really want to talk about is tools in the toolbox. As public health laboratories, we have a lot of tools in the toolbox. Our staff, the laboratory networks we belong in, biosafety and biosecurity has become hugely important. And then really one of the cornerstones of the tools in the toolbox is surveillance. Pete talked about the big black boxes and there's no special one machine. Well, I'm here to say that our surveillance systems that are, you know, grassroots and that are sort of the standard are really, really important for that outbreak detection, for that first case of anthrax that could have happened in Fergus Falls, Minnesota. These systems that we have in place really rely on our partnerships, they rely on our communication, they rely on our epidemiologists, and every one of our state systems is a little bit different, whether we have local public health very involved or whether it's sort of a state-driven system like we have in Minnesota. We all have disease reportable rules that require the physician or the laboratory to report up to the health department to say, hey, we have something like this. And in Minnesota, we actually ask that they call us before it's confirmed, even if they think it is. And that's part of the LRN that I'll talk about in just a minute. Our surveillance systems are human, animal, and environment. And it really is that whole package that's important for early detection of these things. If we talk about environmental surveillance and early detection, one of the questions that were asked in the pre-survey was, does the U.S. have a national level biothreat detection system to detect when a biological attack has occurred? And I'm here to say, yes, we do. How many of you in the room know about BioWatch? Very good. So BioWatch is one of the systems. It's one of the tools in the toolbox. It is right now a manual system such that I have laboratory staff in my facility that do BioWatch testing every day, and thank God I have them because they're my surge capacity. They are my cross-trained capacity to help me with a lot of different things. So BioWatch is really one of the tools in the toolbox, but it really also is more than just the laboratory aspect. There's a lot of communication and collaboration both with EPI, local public health, emergency management, FBI. Many of the things that I'll talk about really do deal with all of that communication and collaboration that occurs across multiple sectors. So the LRN. LRN is one of the tools we have in the toolbox. It's the Laboratory Response Network. Many of our labs belong to a lot of different lab networks. I was going to try to enumerate them, and I decided I couldn't figure it out. But most important is the LRN. It's Lab Response Network. It's part of CDC, and there's a bio side and a chem side. And both of them sort of deal with a tiered network. On the bio side of things, you have your sentinel labs or your clinical labs that are in hospitals, that are in your reference facilities in some places, and they are dealing with the patient. They're dealing with the individual. They're diagnosing disease. And they're connected then to us in the public health sector as the middle of that base, where we're doing confirmation of what they're doing. We're doing additional characterization. We're doing susceptibility testing, things like that. And then the top of the pyramid or the top of the base is the CDC and USAMRID, who are doing methods development and definitive characterization. And that whole LRN system comes together and provides us with standardized reagents and protocols so that the FBI that's utilizing one of these state public health labs for ricin testing, say, for example, they're using the same assays, they're using standardized protocols. The people that have are performing the tests have competency tests. The staff is highly trained in all of our facilities. We do a lot of tests and a lot of training and competency things and proficiency tests, and the staff is very dedicated. I know earlier we talked about would the staff come to the medical facility, and the same is true for our staff. Will we come in and do the work? And yes, we will, and often do very late into the night. So on the LRNC side of things, or the chemical side of things, there also is a very similar system. CDC is sort of at the middle of that. But the chemical side really has engaged 10 public health labs across the country to work with them and help them in our surge capacity for a chemical incident. Minnesota Department of Health is one of those level one laboratories. And not only are we surge capacity, but we also do some methods development, assay development for the CDC. So all of the training and networking and things that we have through that LRN network really allows all of our states to be sort of at that ready, set positioning so that we're ready if an incident were to occur. We saw in Boston the medical community was really ready to respond to that event. And I'd like to say that our public health labs are also ready to respond. We're 24/7, really just there as a warm base. We've have the resources and the technology to respond, whether it's a natural disaster or intentional bioterrorism release. One of the other questions in the survey talked about how important it is for the U.S. to invest in modernizing biothreat surveillance and the early warning detection system. And I think we heard from Pete about that, you know, black box. I actually think we need to do both. We need to continue our investment in the gold standard and the, you know, old conventional methods of routine biosurveillance that's happening within the public health system. We need to utilize that as well as some of these greater technologies. A lot of what I've talked about has to do with the partnerships and outreach. And in Minnesota, we created something we call the Minnesota Laboratory Systems, or MLS. And that's really our integrated network of both public and private laboratories that work together to respond to something like this. That rural lab in Fergus Falls, Minnesota, is a sentinel lab. They rely on us for communication, for training, for education. In their laboratory, they have a poster that I visited their lab since then, and it hangs on the door, and it has the key characteristics of some of these bioterrorism agents that we're talking about. And they said when they got that sample and they looked at that gram stain at 6 o'clock in the morning and then the culture, they went to the poster to see what else they needed to do and called us right away. 10, 15 years ago, they wouldn't have had that information, and they would have been reticent to call us because those relationships and that foundation wasn't there. Now it's there, and they do really call us all the time. So we do provide them with a lot of training. And our idea in the MLS, we built it around 2001. Actually, we had started before 9/11, and it was fortuitous that it was in place, but we knew it couldn't just be about bioterrorism, that it really had to be bigger than that and about quality microbiology practices. So chemical, on the chemical side of the things, we have chemical assessment teams, and we do training and outreach to those groups as well. We really try to make it a well-rounded system. And a part of the trainings we do with both groups is we do what we call a challenge set, and we send them, whether it's yearly on the micro side of things or quarterly on the chem side of things, organisms that they don't normally see, where they can use the protocols we've given them, or they can use the field equipment that the CAT teams or hazmat teams have, and really test and see if they are ready and in that ready set position. Biosafety and biosecurity, you know, I'm not sure that I've heard anyone mention this, but the select agent regulations are some federal regulations that all of our laboratories have to follow, and they're very, very robust. They require us to have very secure facilities, have a lot of documentation on where these organisms are and who has access to them. Many of our facilities in public health are very old. In Minnesota, we're fortunate that we have a new facility, and there's a lot of laboratories that are gaining momentum and getting new facilities, which really is going to be key in, one, the safety of our employees, but also in that biosecurity and biosafety. Technologies, we've heard a lot about technologies, too. All of these things are tools in the toolbox, and I think we can't rely too heavily on any one of the things. We really have to have a multifaceted approach so that we have, as you said, many, many detectors and a lot of data points to collect. Funding is on the decline. It's one of those things what we're all feeling. And I think funding has been very reactive to whatever the situation is, whether it's anthrax letters or pandemic influenza. I think we need to be more proactive. We really need to be more proactive so that we are funding the infrastructure and the base so that we can respond no matter what the agent is, no matter what the event is. And I think we really need to use that funding. And the laboratory, I believe, has used the preparedness funding and has demonstrated in many, many different situations the strong return on investment because we are in that ready-set position. And we have built a capacity across the nation to respond to all hazards. So in summary, I'd just like to sort of look at what do I think the key messages of this are. One of the things I think is that labs do play a key role in the detection and sort of the initiation of is there something going on out there. Public health labs are highly trained and dedicated and are in that ready set position so that we can respond to whatever it is that's occurring. We need a long-term commitment in dollars to the investment to all of those tools in the toolbox. I don't think we want to spend too much money in any one place, but we really want to have that multifaceted approach. Proactive funding, not reactive funding. And then finally, I hope that I've demonstrated this interactive and very multifaceted, lots of different players. Public health labs aren't just public health labs anymore. We really have to deal with the community, with our civil support teams, National Guard assets, FBI, local first responders, local public health. There are so many of us that really have to work together. And it's always easier to respond when you know your partners. So thank you very much.
Well, good morning. I'm Dr. Steve Bucci from the Heritage Foundation and formerly of DOD. I have to tell you, I feel a little bit like the guy who came to the gunfight with nothing but a knife when I look at the other people that have been here speaking. But fortunately, I was a Green Beret in the Army, so I'm pretty good with a knife. So I'm okay with that. Look, this is a really, really timely discussion. It's been interesting to me that I've done a couple of events in the last week or two that were planned for months, in one case a year, and to have them hit just after what happened up in Boston is kind of just, it's eerie. The war on terror has returned to the United States. All right? This is now the front line again. Iraq is done for all intents and purposes. Afghanistan is on a steep decline. Unfortunately, contrary to statements of some folks around this town, the tides of war are not receding. Right? It's still percolating, and they're coming at us. After 9/11, and I was in the Pentagon for 9/11, within 24 hours after those airplanes hit up in New York and hit the Pentagon, the United States was very, very unlikely to get hit with that kind of attack again. Because we immediately, you know, even after we let the airplanes start flying again, we put into place a lot of measures that would stop that particular kind of attack from occurring again. One of them was a thing called Operation Noble Eagle. It's our ability to scramble fighter jets whenever there is some sort of problem on an airplane, and that is in place. I know I was the pretend SecDef for about the first 20 of them, and the first couple of days it was kind of shaky, but they were going to do it. Later, I was part of one that was real. fortunately turned out to not be what we thought it was, and the two fighter jets that followed that airliner into the airport in New York against the way you're supposed to fly an airplane based on the winds didn't have to fire the missiles that had lock on that civilian airliner because he didn't deviate from the path. He landed where he was supposed to. So we put into place those measures. The bad guys kept trying. You know, they did a few other events. Some we stopped by luck, some we stopped by skill, but we kept all the airplanes up there. So we were much better prepared. I can tell you, after what happened in Boston, we are much, much more likely to get hit with that kind of attack again. The reason for that is twofold. One is the vulnerability has now been exposed. All the bad guys in the world, even ones that had nothing to do with this, said, holy smoke, that's a huge gap in their armor. We can probably take advantage of that. And two, what are we going to do? Stop having races, stop having parades, stop having festivals in America? We're not going to do that. Those are iconic American events. I mean, truly all American stuff. So that's not going to stop. So, you know, it puts the onus on our security forces, the police, intelligence, to really work a lot harder to try and protect us. And they're going to do that. But I can tell you, you can't close all those gaps. We've hit a new area of vulnerability, folks. It's been there all along. It's just fortunately the bad guys hadn't figured it out for a while. But now those two young men, alleged bombers, have shown the world that they can hit us there. Well, how does that tie into the bio thing? Well, bio is a threat. We've heard that all morning. It's a huge threat. The bad guys who are out there are still trying to get it. They're working hard at it. Fortunately, as the general mentioned, most of the time they kill themselves when they play with this stuff. That's a good thing in the big cosmic scheme of things. But eventually the bad guys are going to get it. The guy down in Mississippi playing with the ricin, he kind of brought that home to us. All right, that not a very effective attack, but it was real, and it potentially could have gotten through. The flu in China reminds us again that that's out there. Listening to the speakers the rest of the morning, there's some scary stuff running around. Now, you know, you can go back to my colleague at Heritage, Jim Talent, and the report that they did where they said they looked at all the weapons of mass destruction and terrorism stuff, and they said, you know, this is really the one we need to worry about. Hasn't gotten that much attention. This audience, I'm guessing there's probably more folks here who think that that's legit than most in this town. I don't know if you guys know this, but you're kind of a geeky group, all right? This is like mostly a group of people who understand the issue, who've recognized the importance of it. You don't have the masses coming in here. That's unfortunate, not because we need to scare the masses, but we need to educate them, right? And when I say masses, I'm not even talking about all the folks all over the heartland of America. I'm talking about all the people here in Washington, D.C. So we've got to do better with that. Real quick story. I was the DOD rep on the preparation for avian flu. Went into a room almost this big, reps from all the relevant agencies in the U.S. federal government, talking about what we're going to do should pandemic break out in the United States. And at the time, we were looking at avian flu as the possible way it was going to happen. I got to tell you, on one hand, very heartening to see everybody there, everybody willing to work together. You know, people like Maureen who, you know, they had the goods. I mean, they were laying this stuff out here. This is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to do it. But one thing that kind of scared me was there were a lot of people who thought and literally said, well, this is our plan. So, okay, what's your backup if that doesn't work? Yeah, we'll let DOD do it. There was a lot of misconceptions about the overall capacity of the federal government to address these problems. There was a lot of learning that went on. That was either late 2007, early 2008. But, you know, we've grown a lot since then. And I think listening to Maureen, that gave me a very heartening feeling. The key to these a bio incident like this, particularly the really dangerous ones that Keith was talking about, tells you there's people's sons and daughters living in places or who are following ideologies that don't just want to know this so they can do good things, but would love to use it against people they and their parents don't like. That's kind of scary, too. Response is clearly a key. We've got to keep working that. We've got to keep moving in that direction. When something bad starts to happen, the full weight of all of our assets need to be thrown at it. Everybody agrees with that. I don't even think there's that many arguments about who should be in charge and the kind of things that normally pop up in those situations. But right now, we're having a big debate about what the heck should we do before it happens? What about detection? What about, you know, trying to get a jump start on these things? And I got to tell you, I also have an insider, by the way. My son is an Army Chemical Corps officer, and the Army Chemical Corps does chem, bio, rad, nuke. They do all the bad stuff, which is a really interesting thing that sometimes I think my son would be safer if he'd gone in special forces than if he'd done what he's doing. But he said, you know, Dad, our detection stuff is not good enough. We need it to be better. We need that head start when something happens. So keep working, Pete, please. Look, today our detection ability, BioWatch and all the human elements that were described to you are not a perfect system. I don't think anybody here would say they are. You know, we haven't gotten the silver bullet yet. But it's the best we have right now. And every minute it's deployed and every minute it's used, these really smart people that have talked to you learn a little bit more and can turn the screwdriver a little more and fix it and make it a little better. I'll give you a parable addressing another subject. The subject is missile defense. In the last administration in the Department of Defense, we made the decision. Based on my old boss, Secretary Rumsfeld, made the call, and they said, you know what, we can put up some missile defense capabilities, but it's really not perfect yet. We're still working on the details. And he said, well, if we put up what we have today, will we be at less risk than if we do not? And all the smart guys looked at him and said, well, yes. He said, build it. Build it now. Get some risk mitigation for the threat, and then keep working on it and make it better every day till we get to the point where it's as good as it's going to get with the technology we have. That was a different kind of model for looking at science, right? If there's no threat, you can keep the science in the lab, you can keep working on it, you can get it to be wonderful, shiny, perfect. When there's a threat, and that's the only tool you have to use against it, or it's a tool that gives us some significant improvement, then even if it's not perfect yet, it needs to be deployed and then make the real world your laboratory and make it better every day. And that's kind of what I believe we've done with BioWatch and with some of these other methodologies that we're using. It isn't perfect. That's the best we got. The threat's real. We need to prepare for it, and we need to try and mitigate it as much as we can. We need to stop playing politics with this stuff. We need to get serious about it because this isn't a game of gotcha, right? We're not scoring political points. We're trying to protect the nation. And in doing that, we need to take every step possible. And I have to say this because I mentioned it to someone. But, ma'am, your comment about the guys going into the bad zone when we know there's potential for more harm to come from that. I just spent 2 days with a bunch of cops, firefighters, EMTs, docs, some military. Those folks, they know that running into that spot to help those people puts them at risk. It may be another device. It may be some pathogen that was released when the bomb went off. It may be radiation. I've led people like that my whole life. They know what they're doing, and they go in anyway. We can't do any less. We don't necessarily, depending on who you are, have to put your physical life at risk. But we need to stop playing politics, stop trying to promote ourselves, and just do what we need to do to protect the people of this nation. Thank you.
My name is Wes McDermott. I'm with CDC, deployed to D.C. Department of Health. You were talking about the Project Jupiter. I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit more about, given a successful field test of that, where does that go? What application does that have?
It's a good question, and one that I don't have the answer for right now. The ATD itself is a program that will kick off in the fall. We'll run for 3 years, 2 years, and then the exit criteria, how we gauge our success is something that we're actually grappling with right now. And so the outcome of that is exportable. And so obviously Korea is a selection, but it's really indicative of essentially forward operating positions that the Department of Defense may be dealing with in multiple locations. And so, you know, in one case, Korea could be a model for Bagram, could be a model for any other forward operating position. And so ATDs are great because you can try things, and if they work, you roll those into formal acquisition programs. If they don't work, you've learned something too. And so ATDs are not formal acquisition programs, so they have a beginning and an end, but in effect, it's a learning opportunity for us. And so it's a great question, and one right now without a specific answer that I can give you that's satisfactory.
Hi, Bob McCray, George Washington University. For the JPO guy and the rest of the panel, it's really kind of a three-part question. I'm a former Fed myself. I go back to the days of the trilats, and I'll bring that back into the question later on. It seems that one of the difficulties with detection, you're always running behind the state-of-the-art in biotech and synthetic biology. In effect, the spectrum of agents that you worry about far exceeds their detection capability. So given that that's one inherent problem, what do you think can be done, similar to what we did with the trilats years ago, to get some nations engaged in sharing their detection technologies and with it their forensic technologies that would help us to draw closer to making a distinction between a disease that is deliberate versus one that is naturally occurring? The part two of the question has to do with how this interagency cooperation takes place. I used to heard a couple interagency meetings on HSPD 10 years ago on the question of attribution. That's one of the reasons my hair is gray, is because we found it in that experience that no one wanted to take full responsibility for the medical legal aspects of attribution. It still remains a point of national policy that we will conduct an attribution study and render a decision. So the second part of the question is, how do we get there given the interagency differences? And the third one, very short one, is given the differences between the marathon and a pandemic and the way you handle the disease, what are we doing in this time of diminished emphasis on BW to make sure that the large cities are prepared as they can be for a suspicious outbreak?
Okay. So the first question was essentially how can we leverage the investments that other sites, countries, agencies are doing? And then there was a technology component that was implied in the question. I'm gonna take a cheap bailout on the technology one in that by tiering multiple systems with different attributes, for example, generic particle detections that do generic side scatter for NAD or tryptophan side scatter, and then layering those with more specific triggers that are identifiers and things of that nature, by creating depth to our layered strategy, that's the way we can deal with it given the current state of technology. So that's going to have to be the answer that I give for that. How to essentially get the best that those are, that are out there have to offer was really the basis of that question. The first thing that is actually a strange answer is that we need to essentially document the requirements that are specific to each of our agencies, countries, missions. And then a requirements building process will allow us to overlay those requirements and realize that a Border Patrol agent needs a device that's very much similar to what a soldier may need that's going site to site to site. And the fact is that when you start binning things into mission requirements, you'll find that what looked like two totally different needs are really not that much different. And you have a common core system that can be augmented. And so I would say that, believe it or not, the place to start is in an inherent trans-global requirements-building process. And really, that has to stem from a recognition by senior leadership at very high levels that they want that to occur and that they will essentially be willing to pitch in their investment dollars into a multi-year strategy, and this is going to take a significant amount of time. The last question you asked, I don't really have the best answer for that question because it was very generic in that, what are we doing? And so I would defer that to Stephen Bucci. So the microbial forensics strategy, the National Microbial Forensics Strategy, was signed in 2009 and has formed some subsequent spin-off strategies in which multiple inside the United States we're taking a more cohesive look at biological forensics. Obviously, HSPD 10 formed MBAC and MBFAC, but it's really broader than that, and there's a lot of equity. There's a national strategy that's laying out the gaps, and there's been a follow-on, and I understand that there's a significant series of actions. That's going to roll out over the next 5 years, but there is a lot of pooling of capability, and there's a lot of talk. The problem is that it coincided with the downturn in our economic ability, and so without a series of formal requirements to resource that desire, it has essentially gained very little momentum.
And my answer is pretty short. You know, it's going to take leadership. Leadership has to break down the walls. You know, we've been trying to do that since 9/11, and now, unfortunately, I think we're trying to rebuild some of the silos of excellence that we had before. We've got to share the information. We've got to share the assets. That takes leadership, and it takes leadership beyond departmental levels. It takes leadership beyond agency levels. It has to reach across the federal, state, local authorities. You know, we do this in a lot of areas, and we do it well in some and very poorly in others. And that just comes down to leadership. And I know that sounds very trite, but it also has the virtue of being true. And we're not getting that right now. It's not a slam on anybody. This particular threat, you know, it's not that high profile right now. I don't know, my good friend David, he mentioned, who would have thought having ricin showing up at a letter to the president and several senators wouldn't even be on page 2, you know, it'd be on page 4 or 5 below the fold. Well, it wasn't just the timing of it with Boston, though, in this case, you know, a lot, but people don't understand this threat. They don't see it. And when I say that, again, I'm not just talking about the good old American citizens. I'm talking about a lot of our leaders. You know, they got a lot of things making their heads hurt right now, and they see this one as another one that they don't want to have to deal with. And they're going to have to deal with it. If they don't, they'll have to deal with it after the boom or after the whatever you call it when this stuff starts in bio. You know, it's going to really be painful. So I hear what you're saying, but it's going to take leaders that order the walls to be broken down and get people to cooperate and do what needs to be done.
Question for Dr. Emanuel or comment. I'm involved with the DHS S&T First Responder Resource Group. And my observation is, like yours, that what we need is first responders and detection capability. Isn't that different from what the military needs? I've seen the 1401 program, DOD's 1401 program. There's HSARPA, there's DARPA, there's the FBI S&T. Everybody's sort of out there going, hey, this would be great. We should do this. And then there's somebody, a program manager, goes, oh, that's a great idea. Do that. And it seems to me that you're exactly right. We need a lot more coordination about who has business requirements, what they need, how to build it, what the state of the art is. And my experience at S&T is that I have yet to see DOD folks at our meetings, and I have yet to be invited to any DOD meetings. So I'd put it out there that we as a group of people who are responsible for making our needs known to you need to do a better job, but the feds need to do a better job about bringing this all together. I could be totally incorrect. Maybe all the Fed agencies are sitting down and talking to each other about this, but that's just not my perception.
Well, thank you, everyone. I'd like to ask one more question, and it's certainly directed to all the panelists we had today, and I thank you all, but it equally as important, it's directed to all of you out there. Dr. Runge and I, we sit down and talked about today's meeting, and we've talked with this with General Reeves. We all get involved in this discussion on decision science. How does the country craft priorities? And in all of our talks today, we kind of rubbed up against it a little bit. But last, Dr. Wells talked about, you know, this decisions that go back to 1962 to replace a nuclear deterrent with a biological deterrent or biological weapons. And obviously over the last 50 years, you know, we've spent a lot of money in nuclear. And no one really, in my world, really debates that. They didn't really say that money was poorly spent. You know, nothing happened. We didn't have a nuclear holocaust like so many feared, predicted. It came very close, but it didn't. Well, that same decision science doesn't seem to be migrating in the area of the biodefense program. It's just not up there. We all agree that it doesn't get the front pages, doesn't make the fold. So here's what the question to you all is. How can you help me to do a better job to get this message out there? Are there questions? Are there ping points? Are there other meetings like this? You know, we're in a publishing business, and our readership is predominantly the responders, the receivers, the planners, and so forth. But lately, these reports are getting more and more traction with people that are involved in policy. So going back, if you would all email me at publisher@domprep.com and pose these questions or suggestions or ideas. Do we need more meetings? Do we need to get different people in the room? How can we change this paradigm of decision science and get the priorities realigned with the current threats that we have today? So with that, I thank you all, and it's been a great morning, and thank you all for coming.